The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Wanna take a ride? Broadcasting from the sprawling outskirts of the Florida Everglades in the intellectual wilderness of South Lauderdale, the outer regions of humanity that people move to just because it doesn't snow. Yeah. This is the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Tuesday. It's the start of a brand new week here at the Nicole Sandler Show. And oh my goodness, YouTube is still not right. You know, I messed with it over the weekend. I upgraded to the newest version of this software that I use to stream live to YouTube. It's called Wirecast, and it's still messed up. So hopefully we'll make it through today. We may have another show with audio only, in which case I really apologize to you YouTubers. I promise you I will work on it tonight and try to figure out what the hell is going wrong. In the meantime, we got a busy, busy show for you today with so much going on in the world. I'm going to do things sort of backwards, the opposite of the way I usually start the show with a look at the news of the day. Today, I'm going to save the news for last because I have a couple of interviews to share with you. The first one, I actually ran yesterday on the broadcast. Yes, I'm still filling in for Brad and Desi. They should be back, well, hopefully next week, by Monday, if not before. And I'll let them fill you in on what's been going on. But, you know, Brad lost his father, and so I've been doing double duty trying to keep his show going along with mine. And what a time for them to be out, right? Because keeping a handle on everything that's happening in the news is pretty daunting. It's a daunting task because there's so much going on. But, you know, we'll work it in today, along with everything else. So this interview that I want to start with, when I awoke to the news, was it just yesterday morning that we woke up to hear that Donald Trump was tweeting that he's, you know, pulling the troops out of northeastern Syria, which normally would be a good thing, right? I mean, yeah, I want to get us out of these wars. We need to stop. It's madness. However, Donald Trump doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. He obviously knows nothing about the Kurds. And you know, look, he's the president now. He should do his homework and learn what he's talking about before he opens his stupid mouth. But, you know, I, a few years ago, was introduced to a woman named, I want to get her name right, Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman. Now, Bayan Rahman is the Kurdistan regional government representative to the United States. And when I got to talk with her, it was 2015. It was July of 2015. So it was 4 years ago. The you know, I didn't know much about the Kurds. I really didn't. So I took this as an opportunity to, you know, how Stephen Colbert on the old Colbert Report used to do better know a congressional district. Well, I looked at this as better know a world region. And I say region because Kurdistan isn't actually a country. So with no further ado, I want to get to this now. We are going to talk about the Supreme Court today and the case they heard today, and we will get to the news, but so we're doing it in sort of reverse order. So I'm going to start today with this interview I did with Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman in, again, from July of 2014. I'm so confused. Hopefully this will clarify a few things for you.
Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, it's Bayan.
Bayan. Okay.
Yes.
You're the Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the United States. You know, a lot of people here, unfortunately, we have a decent educational system in the U.S., but I think we lack when it comes to geography, world geography. I'll tell you, my daughter I adopted from Kazakhstan, which, as you know, is a huge nation, and so I can't tell you how many people, when they learn she's from Kazakhstan, say, "What's that?" They don't. It's kind of sad and embarrassing, but Kurdistan is even more complicated because Kurdistan isn't isn't a country. You're not a nation. You're a region. Can you explain what Kurdistan is?
Yes, sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to say it's a great pleasure to be with you today. So thank you for inviting me. Kurdistan is actually divided, and a piece of Kurdistan exists in four different countries. These four countries are Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And Kurdistan in this shape was formed just after the First World War. And actually, President Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president at the time, came up with a concept of self-determination, that peoples around the world have the right to determine what state, what nation they want to be part of. Unfortunately, in the post-First World War discussions by the victorious Allies, Kurdistan lost out. And so instead of having one Kurdish state in the Middle East, the Kurds were divided into these four countries, Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. So you have Kurdish people like me. I was born in Iraq. My parents were Iraqi Kurds, but my husband is from Kurdistan in Iran. My maternal grandmother was a Kurd from Syria, and I have many relatives who are Kurds in Turkey. So even though we have these borders that divide us, we are all linked by blood. We are linked by blood and belonging. And we all have the same aims and the same customs, the same language, the same aspirations. We are one people.
Wow. You know, I'm looking at a map right now, and I have it up on the screen. We put this out on YouTube, so people who are listening can see the map as well. And the Kurdistan region is huge. I mean, Kurdistan is larger than, much larger than Syria, one of the nations it cuts across the northernmost tip of Syria. It's larger than Iraq. It also, you know, shares a huge border with Iran and to the north with Turkey. And I know that, for instance, we hear a lot about Iraqi Kurdistan, so the different, you know, the countries with which you share some land, say the Turkish Kurdistan region, are they subject to different rules than perhaps those who are more in the Iranian region?
Yes, what's happened is that over the past 100 years or so since the First World War, since, you know, there was this new settlement in Europe and then also in the Middle East, the Kurds in the four parts of Kurdistan, in those four countries, in a way have lived parallel lives, but also have had different experiences. So the Kurds in Turkey for many decades were not allowed to even speak Kurdish. Were not allowed to give their children Kurdish names, and the state of Turkey denied even the existence of anything called Kurds or Kurdistan.
Wow.
Fortunately, and this was, of course, extremely destructive of Kurdish society. It tore at the fabric of Kurdish society. But I have to say that over the past decade or 15 years or so, there has been a great deal of progress in Turkey, so that now the language is no longer banned. There are even schools that teach Kurdish, not many, admittedly. And in the recent elections, just a few weeks ago in Turkey, for the first time, a Kurdish political party, the HDP, won 13% of the vote. And this is the first time that Turkey has a Kurdish political party with Kurdish members of parliament. There have been Kurdish members of parliament before in Turkey, but they stood as independent candidates. This is the first time that they stood under the umbrella of a Kurdish party. So this is the situation in Turkey. And then, of course, there is the Kurdish organization in Turkey called the PKK, which has engaged in an armed struggle against the Turkish state. In Syria, again, you know, looking back over the past several decades or even 100 years or so, the Kurds in Syria have been equally badly treated. They have been ignored. There were even, and they still are today, a few hundred thousand, maybe 300,000 to 400,000 Kurds in Syria who have no citizenship rights whatsoever. So that means they can't own their own house. They are disqualified from getting government jobs. Their children cannot go to university and so on. The number of Kurds in Syria today is about 3 million. The number of Kurds in Turkey is maybe 20 million, maybe 25 million. We don't know. In Iran, there are about 10 or 12 million Kurds. Wow. And Iran also, unfortunately, has had a policy of oppression against the Kurdish people going back in the Shah's time and then again under the Islamic Republic as well. So again, the Kurdish people's rights in Iranian Kurdistan are not necessarily recognized. And then coming to Iraq, which is where I'm from, and I represent the Kurdistan region in Iraq in my post in Washington. In Iraq, perhaps your listeners have more information about us than other parts of Kurdistan. Sure. You know, Iraq was a dictatorship for many years under Saddam Hussein. But honestly, even before Saddam Hussein, Iraq was never a stable country. There were always rapid and violent changes of government in Iraq. So it's always had a very bloody and violent history. Under Saddam, it just reached a peak so that as he strengthened his dictatorship and his grip on the country, everybody, it didn't matter whether you were Kurdish or Arab, everybody lived in fear, and there was a culture of cruelty, fear, and silence. And then particularly against the Kurds, because we rose up against Saddam repeatedly. We never accepted his rule. He was extremely brutal. He used chemical weapons to bomb civilian communities, and most famously or notoriously, he bombed the city of Halabja in 1988. With chemical gas, chemical weapons, and 5,000 people died in that one incident. But he used chemical weapons against about 200 communities, so that's villages, towns, hamlets. And he also engaged in a genocide campaign that he called Anfal, and this was his final solution for the Kurdish people in Iraq. And then, fortunately, for us, he invaded Kuwait, and then, and unfortunately, the United States and the coalition pushed him out of Kuwait, and we rose up against Saddam Hussein again in early 1991, and he put down this uprising very, very brutally, and over 2 million Kurdish people fled to the mountains, and some of your listeners may remember in 1991 the TV images of millions of people on the mountains dying of starvation, dying from the cold. It was just biblical scenes. And again, the United States and Britain and other countries came to our aid. And this was a big turning point in the history of the people of Kurdistan in Iraq.
So now you are the representative. Again, we're speaking with Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman, the Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the U.S. The Kurdistan Iraqi, do you have three other counterparts, or do you represent all of Kurdistan to the U.S.?
Kurdistan in Iraq is the only part of Kurdistan that is officially recognized as a region. So we're fortunate that after the liberation, we call it a liberation of Iraq in 2003. I realize that there are many people in the United States and other countries who don't see it as a liberation. But, you know, if you have lived under a dictatorship who is committing genocide against your people, it feels like a liberation when that dictator is removed. So after the liberation of Iraq, we Iraqis, that's the Kurds, Sunnis, Shias, sat down and negotiated a constitution. And in that constitution, the Kurdistan region in Iraq is recognized as a region. Our regional parliament, our regional president and prime minister, and our representatives abroad, so my post, all of these are recognized. So it is only the Kurdistan region in Iraq that has these positions of president, prime minister, parliament, representatives overseas. The other parts of Kurdistan in Turkey, Iran, Syria, they have party political representatives who might, you know, be working in Washington or London or Paris.
I see. All right. So that's the overview of Kurdistan, the history, and where you are today. I'm still stuck on the the liberation of Iraq. Obviously, over here, a lot of our finger pointing during we're in a new presidential cycle, and we're still talking about the flawed decision to invade Iraq. After all, Iraq never attacked us; they were not a threat to us. We were either lied to or misled, or some combination of the two. But for the most part, most Americans are pretty united in the belief that this was a huge international blunder that cost certainly Americans unimaginable amounts in lives and treasure, and the Iraqi people as well. But are you guys, if we could go back 15 years or so, would you prefer that we did come in and get rid of Saddam, or prefer that we would have left you guys alone?
Well, first, I do recognize and I have heard those points of view many times, and I respect the point of view that the intervention in Iraq or the liberation of Iraq should not have happened and it was a mistake. And also, I should express our gratitude to all of the Americans who fought in Iraq, and particularly to those who lost their lives or who were injured. I have always felt that for the families of those soldiers who lost their lives in Iraq, it must be so disheartening to constantly hear that the intervention was a disaster, it was a failure, that Iraq is a failure. Well, there is one corner of Iraq, the Kurdistan region in Iraq, which is successful. We do have a democracy. We do have, we had a prospering economy until ISIS came. And we are grateful to the United States, and we appreciate the sacrifice, both in blood and treasure, as you put it, that the United States has made. And I do want to genuinely thank the people and the government and the Congress of the United States for everything that has been done for the people of Iraq, and particularly for the people of Kurdistan.
Wow.
I would say, okay. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, you may very well be the first person to have said that.
I'm sure I'm not the first Kurdish person to have said that, and it is genuinely felt. It is genuinely felt because, as I said earlier, in 1991, when the United States and the other countries came to our aid because Saddam was again attacking us and millions of people went to the mountains, and they were dying. They were dying by the thousands from the elements, from starvation, from cold. The United States and Britain and other countries created a safe haven so that people could return to their homes, and then they created and implemented a no-fly zone over Kurdistan, and this enabled us to have our first ever elections in Kurdistan.
Wow.
That then led to the creation of our parliament, our government, and all of the institutions that we have today. And again in 2003, this was another turning point at which the United States intervened in Iraq. And for us in Kurdistan, it gave us another break. And over the next decade, 2003 to 2013, we were able to build our economy. We were able to open our doors to the international community. Because don't forget, whenever there's a dictatorship, the doors are closed. Dictators do not want you to travel. They do not want foreigners to come in either. So just the fact that people could breathe, they could travel, foreigners could come and see us, we could do business, all of this opened a new entrepreneurial spirit in Kurdistan, and we have really done our best to build our society. going back to your point about was it a liberation or was it an invasion or was it a mistake, in my opinion, the liberation was correct. It was right to remove a dictator who not only terrorized and murdered his own people, but he caused instability around the Middle East and he did harm U.S. interests. However, that doesn't mean that everything went perfectly, that everything went smoothly after the liberation. Certainly there were many mistakes after the liberation of Iraq, and we all recognize that. But I think it's important that people like me are given the opportunity, and I thank you for doing that, to thank the servicemen and women who sacrificed their lives, or maybe they're wounded, or maybe they lost friends Iraq. And we appreciate that very much. And we appreciate that they live with that for the rest of their lives.
Well, on behalf of them, thank you for that. Again, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with the Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the U.S., Bayan Sami Abdul-Rahman. You're based in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you split your time. But, I so appreciate the history there. I'm learning so much from you. So now, after Saddam is toppled, the American forces were training the Iraqi army. There was a status of forces agreement made by George W. Bush with the Iraqi government before Bush left office that had us withdrawing our troops from Iraq over a certain amount of time, and so President Obama followed through on that agreement. And now, once we're gone, it seems like everything kind of fell apart. A lot of blame is being pointed at Obama for following through on that status of forces agreement and withdrawing the troops per the schedule that was agreed upon. The political divide over here. So the Republicans are saying it's Obama's fault. The rise of ISIS is President Obama's fault because we no longer had this robust military presence over there. Obviously, the Iraqi army had troubles before we got there and had troubles after we got there. We're seeing two groups, really, in your region stepping up to fight against ISIS. One is, shockingly enough for many of us over here, Iran. The other are the Kurds. Does Kurdistan have its own army? I mean, you're apart and separate from Iraq, from the other nations?
We have our own army, and we call our soldiers Peshmerga, and I think I'm so happy.
I know that name.
Yes,
okay.
And I'm so happy that so many Americans use the word Peshmerga to describe our fighters. But Peshmerga for us means soldier, and it literally means those who face death.
Wow.
And so our Peshmerga are actually, according to the Iraqi constitution, part of Iraq's defense mechanism or defense system.
So with the Peshmerga really doing the heavy lifting over there, because they are, Iraq, I don't know what's going on there. It seems like all the weapons we left behind for the Iraqi army has fallen into the hands of ISIS. There have been a lot of calls for Kurdistan to become its own independent state. Certainly, I know you'd be a much better ally of the United States than any other player in the region. What's stopping Kurdistan from becoming an independent state? How would that happen?
I think that's a question that every Kurd asks themselves every day. Honestly, every Kurd that I know wants an independent Kurdistan in their heart.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the political realities sometimes dictate something else. What we have said in Kurdistan and Iraq is that we will hold a referendum within the next year or two. There isn't a specific time frame right now, but in the foreseeable future, we will have a referendum so that all Iraqi Kurds can vote on the question, do you want Kurdistan in Iraq to be an independent state? And I can guarantee you the answer will be a resounding yes. And then our leadership will have the mandate from the public to go about achieving that independence. Now, in an ideal world, I'm very sorry. In an ideal world, we would achieve independence in a peaceful manner. We want to be able to speak to our friends and colleagues in Baghdad and explain to them that from a Kurdish point of view, Baghdad, or Iraq rather, just doesn't work for us. And I can come to that in a moment. And that the people of Kurdistan have expressed their will for an independent state. And I believe that over the past decade, because Kurdistan region has functioned as a prosperous, vibrant region, because we've had democratic elections, we have a very vibrant parliament, a very argumentative parliament. And so I think we have shown that we can function as an entity. We have oil that we can export. We are building other industries in Kurdistan. So I hope that over that time, and I believe that we have shown to many friends in the neighborhood and also in the international community that we can function as an independent state. It doesn't mean that everything will be smooth and perfect, but certainly being part of Iraq is not smooth and perfect.
No. The speculation, certainly over here, is that Iraq as a nation is faltering, and that, you know, for instance, you talked about the borders being drawn after World War One. They were drawn kind of haphazardly, and there are those who are saying that, you know, that the nation of Iraq may not survive, and that perhaps Iraq would be split up, Kurdistan would become its own nation, and maybe the nation of Iraq would disappear.
Well, everything is possible, and yeah. Borders are not sacred.
No.
So I think, and particularly with all this volatility and instability that we see across the Middle East today, not just in Iraq, but if you look at, you have Iraq, you have the crisis in Syria,
yes.
You have a war in Yemen, you have Libya disintegrating, those terrorist attacks in Tunisia.
Yes.
Really, there's a sort of a wave of instability and turbulence that is going through the Middle East. And at the heart of much of this, not all of it, but at the heart of much of this, is the Shia Sunni rivalry, which goes back centuries.
Right.
And has not been solved over centuries, and I don't think will be solved in the near future either. So much of this is really beyond what we Kurds or Iraqis might plan or might want. A lot of it is just even bigger and wider than that. But, you know, I would argue that we in Kurdistan have proven ourselves to be a reliable partner to the United States. We are building a democracy. We have religious freedom in Kurdistan. Excuse me. We have religious freedom in Kurdistan. We have so many minorities, the Yazidis, the Christians,
right.
Shabak, Kakis, others coming and sheltering in Kurdistan because they've had to flee from ISIS.
Mm.
We have all of this, and we believe that Kurdistan can be a strategic partner for the United States, a stable and still point in this very, very volatile Middle East. And I think the United States needs partners like
oh,
that,
yes.
And we, of course, also need partners like the United States to be with us.
Speaking of partners, you know, I sometimes politics and war can make strange bedfellows. I mentioned earlier that, again, the Kurds and the Iranians are the two areas in your neighborhood that are really stepping up to battle ISIS. I mean, I learned today, astoundingly, that Saudi Arabia is, you know, building a fence, a wall around the nation. That's brilliant. They sound like our own Republicans here. What is the relationship between Kurdistan and Iran?
Well, Kurdistan region, our policy, Kurdistan region's policy is to have good relations with all of our neighbors. And,
what
you know,
a concept.
Iran. Yes. And especially when you're a region, you're not even a sovereign state, you don't have much choice. Iran is a powerful neighbor. It's a player not just in the Middle East, but even on the international stage. Iran has to be taken account of. So from our perspective, we need to have good relations with Iran. And we do a lot of trade with Iran in sort of, for example, food and agriculture and that sort of thing. And in the early days when ISIS, you know, started to attack the Kurdistan region last summer, it was Iran that came to our help before anybody else. And this was in the very, very early days when we had no idea if anybody would help us. And, you know, when you're in that situation, you'll take the help wherever it comes from.
Sure.
Fortunately, President Obama did order airstrikes, and this was a game changer. It gave every Kurd the confidence that the United States has our backs. And we were taken by surprise by ISIS, but we regrouped, and our Peshmerga have, you know, been taking back territory from ISIS. We have taken back about 20,000 square kilometers. And any part of Iraq that is considered Kurdish is now under Kurdish control, and ISIS has been pushed out.
Wow.
So we were able to just, you know, with knowing that we have U.S. support and the airstrikes are extremely effective, the support that we have from the U.S. advisors on the ground has been very, very helpful. The United States and the coalition have been sending weapons to the Peshmerga as well, not as much as we would like, not in the quality or quantity that we would like, but nevertheless, the weapons have been coming, and again, they've been instrumental in enabling our Peshmerga, who are still, frankly, outgunned by ISIS, but, you know, our Peshmerga have a cause to fight for, and they fight, and we've been very effective against ISIS and have pushed them back.
That's incredible, and that's so good to hear. You know, now we need to get that on all fronts. I know we're running short on time. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, in the wake of the recent news, and I know that obviously Kurdistan was not involved in this negotiation for the Iranian nuclear deal, but as a neighbor and an ally of the United States, I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts on what happened this week.
It's a difficult question to answer because there are so many unknowns, and I think a deal is better than no deal. However, whether there was an agreement or not, what really concerns us is that the Middle East is heading for an arms race, even bigger than any arms race we've seen previously in the region. You know, the Gulf countries are extremely concerned about Iran's nuclear program. And so I think this agreement, if it really is based on verification, as President Obama has said, then that would provide reassurance to the United States and to the Gulf countries in the Middle East. And for the Iranians, it allows them the breathing space because the sanctions will be lifted. So in a way, it reads as a win-win situation. But I think the concern for all of us in the Middle East is that really the Middle East is generally heading for an arms race. And this is already an area that is extremely volatile, and that has to concern all of us.
So going forward, Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman, what can we do as allies, as neighbors? What would you like the average American to know and possibly to take action on going forward?
Well, one area of immediate action is to help us with a humanitarian crisis. Kurdistan region's population is about 5.2 million. We have taken in about 1.8 million. Displaced people from Iraq and refugees from Syria. So we have had a huge jump in our population in a very short period of time. And many of these refugees are living in camps, but many others are sleeping rough in half-finished buildings, in construction sites, on the roadside, in forests. The United Nations is, of course, helping us with the refugees, but the scale of the problem is just so vast that we can't cope, and the UN is saying that it's short of money. So any assistance that your listeners or the people of the United States can give us through their churches, through charities, anything. I mean, the refugees need everything. They need blankets. They need boots to manage winter. They need books for their children. They need health care. So any kind of assistance on the humanitarian front would be very, very much appreciated and would make a difference to people's lives.
All right. Bayan Sami Abdul-Rahman, the Kurdistan representative to the United States. I almost got through without saying Kyrgyzstan, and there I blew it at the end. It's so nice talking with you. I'm honored that you came on this show. I so appreciate it. You've opened my mind in great ways. I mean, a lot of stuff that I did not know, I'm sure some of our listeners didn't know either. So I thank you, and I hope we can talk again.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Me as well. All right. Take care.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bayan Sami Abdul-Rahman is her name. That, in case you weren't here at the beginning of the interview, that was recorded 4 years ago. It was July of 2015 when I spoke with her. That's why she was talking about President Obama. And interestingly enough, she talked about Saudi Arabia building a wall. how things have changed and how they have not. So anyway, I hope you found that as informative as I did. You know, this news broke about Trump's ridiculous statement to Turkey's Erdogan about, invading Syria and taking out the Kurds. I knew I had to rerun that interview for you. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Now, I just checked Bayan's Twitter feed because she is on Twitter. She's on Twitter at Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, Rahman, R-A-H-M-A-N, Bayan Rahman, all one word. And the tweet, I've been checking it for the last couple of days, and she hasn't tweeted anything really until today, 2 hours ago. She tweeted out a Kurdistan regional government statement on developments in northeastern Syria. So let me click through to it and I'll read you the whole statement. It's not very long. They wrote, "The Kurdistan regional government is deeply concerned by the United States' decision to withdraw from the safe zone in northeastern Syria and by reports of a potential unilateral military operation by Turkey. The government calls on Turkey, as a member of the global coalition, to try to avoid any initiative that would undermine the progress made against ISIS, including jeopardizing the secure detention of terrorist fighters. The consequences of military escalation have implications far beyond Syria's borders, creating the conditions for a return of ISIS and a mass displacement of people. It is crucial, therefore, all parties in the conflict, including the Kurdish parties, engage in dialogue to de-escalate the situation." What a concept. "The government has consistently stated that the crisis must be solved through a stable political solution which enshrines the rights of all Syrians, including the Kurdish people." And then it concludes with this. "The Kurdistan region paid a huge sacrifice in the campaign to defeat ISIS and currently hosts 1.1 million displaced people, many of whom fled that conflict. It is the responsibility of the international community to prevent this happening again. The KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, will continue to closely monitor the situation and work through multiple channels on this issue." So there's the latest regarding Kurdistan. Oh, boy. It is an ugly, ugly situation. And in fact, on the broadcast tonight, and I'll run it here either tomorrow or later in the week, I've got an interview with a gentleman who worked in the State Department under under Bush, Clinton, and Obama. He's a director of the Program on Peace Building and Human Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. It's a great interview. And so he goes into a little more of the current situation in Kurdistan. He wrote the book on Kurdistan. His book that's been out about 6 months is called The Great Betrayal, How America Abandoned the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. So anyway, that interview is coming up on the broadcast tonight, here later in the week. Again, I'm doing double duty and trying to to shuffle guests and interviews and keep it all straight. It's not always easy. So, of course, I forgot to begin the show with our funny. And I figured, you know what? We could use a palate cleanser between that interview with Bayan Rahman and our interview coming up dealing with the case that was heard at the Supreme Court today. So we will. We'll have our palate cleanser, courtesy of the one and only Boca Brittany Summers.
Whistleblowers, those who bravely come forward to reveal wrongdoing. Now you can have the greatest whistleblowers of all time blow their whistle for you. Yes, it's whistling whistleblowers with the courage to step forward and whistle. Whistle along with the whistleblowers. It's easy. Just put your legs together, bend over, and blow. We now know the identity of Watergate's deep throat, but the safety of today's whistleblowers must be taken into account and must remain anonymous, as this whistleblower will tell you.
I am the Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
Happy whistleblowers. Sad whistleblowers. Don't miss your chance to have all the whistleblowers for your collection of whistleblowers. Not to mention the most famous whistleblower of all.
The greatest whistleblowers of all time is now available at all Peaches Records and Tapes.
Oh, that was the wrong one. I meant to hit the applause. The one and only wonderful Boca Brittany Summers. All right, now that we got that out of the way, yesterday was the beginning of the new term of the Supreme Court. You know, it starts the first Monday in October, and they heard one case yesterday, but today was the first major case of the term. And I don't mean to demean whatever cases they heard yesterday. In fact, I remember hearing something about it. It was kind of interesting. But today, what the Supreme Court was pondering is a question that it just is so ridiculous to me, but it's where we are right now.
They're hearing oral arguments in three cases, all arguing that LGBTQ people should be protected from employment discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination based on sex, right? It sounds like a no-brainer, but this is Donald Trump's America, and currently 20 states, only 20 states, have explicit statewide employment protections for LGBTQ people. It's insane. And here in Florida, I personally know people who have been fired because they put a picture of, he and his spouse on his desk. Therefore, it became known that he was gay and he was fired. It's insane. But that's the question that was before the Supreme Court today. So I wanted to get a, I lost the interview. Hold on a second. I got to find it again. I did speak with Jasmine Beach Ferrara. She's the executive director of the Campaign for Southern Equality. And here's that interview. On the line with us now is Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferrara. She's executive director of the Campaign for Southern Equality. Before we get into the reason for our conversation today, can you explain a little bit about the Campaign for Southern Equality?
Absolutely, and thanks for having me on. The Campaign for Southern Equality is based in Asheville, North Carolina, and we work across the entire South to promote full LGBTQ equality, both under the law, but also in how we live our daily lives. We were launched in 2011 and are very honored to get to work in the policy arena, on litigation, provide direct services, and do grassroots organizing.
Now, there's a reverend in front of your name. Are you a member of the clergy?
I am. I'm an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ.
Gotcha. Okay, well, today, the reason I'm calling you today is because, the Supreme Court kicked off its term yesterday, first Monday in October, and today they're going to hear oral arguments in actually three cases combined into one kind of big umbrella about LGBTQ rights. And the central question here is if people should be protected from employment discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination based on sex. And it's astounding. I mean, I live in Florida, so I'm also in the South. But down here, you can be fired simply because you're gay, and it happens all the time. I'm constantly seeing things in the newspaper where a couple gets married, one of the couple goes back to work after the honeymoon, puts a picture of them together, he and his spouse perhaps, on his desk, and is subsequently fired. This is legal, not only here, but in many states in the country?
That's right. And so many people are just as surprised as you are to learn that. There are 20 states in the country that provide state-level protections against employment discrimination for LGBTQ folks. That means there's 30 states that are uncovered,
wow.
And that includes the entire South. So you can still be fired for being LGBTQ in any southern state and in 30 states across the country. And when you really break this down, as you were doing in the kind of anecdote you related, it just shocks the conscience. You know, what this is about is someone being fired from a job they're perfectly capable of fulfilling simply because of either who they are or who they love. What we know from years of polling is that a significant majority of Americans, close to 70%, support protections for LGBTQ folks in the area of employment. And despite that, however, we haven't seen the movement we need to either in state legislatures or at the federal level from Congress. So today's arguments before the Supreme Court are momentously significant. We're all following very closely along. This ruling will be significant for people across the entire country, and it has the opportunity to help our nation move closer to the promise of full equality under the law for everyone, and to really mark a significant step forward in the decades-long fight for full equality for LGBTQ people.
It's about time. Now, I mentioned there are three cases coming together. Can you give us a little thumbnail on each of the three? Because they address different aspects or different, I don't know, subsections of the LGBTQ community?
Yeah, that's right. There's three cases that have now been joined for today's arguments. And they're cases on behalf of very brave plaintiffs who experienced or on behalf of someone who experienced employment discrimination, either because of their sexual orientation, meaning they were gay or lesbian, or because of their gender identity. One of the most high-profile cases is a woman who transitioned and was fired from her job at a funeral home as a result of that. Another is a case coming from Georgia, so our neighbors here in the South, of a man who was publicly employed by a county, had a successful career, and shortly after starting to come out more in his public life, lost his job as a result of that.
Unbelievable.
These are very brave folks who not only have endured the experience of being fired simply for being who they are, but have now, on behalf of our entire community, taken this brave stand to argue these cases and hopefully get the resolution we finally need to establish that Title VII does, in fact, apply to the LGBTQ community.
Right. And it's so important. Again, this is the first big high-profile case the court is hearing this term. There are a number that some were announced just this week. They're going to take up the abortion question. It's kind of frightening when you look at the makeup of this current court with two Donald Trump appointees on it. Does that frighten you?
This is a high-stakes time in our country around so many issues, LGBTQ issues, reproductive justice and abortion rights, immigration, the list goes on and on. And what we certainly believe in is that we have to use every tool available to us to fight for rights that are promised under the Constitution. And that includes bringing cases to the Supreme Court. We are absolutely determined to win the right to protect folks from employment discrimination. The court's ruling, which is expected sometime this spring or early summer, is one vehicle for doing that. But we're also advocating each and every day for the passage of the Equality Act, which has been proposed. It's passed through the House at the federal level, and it would be a legislative solution to this issue. So I think anyone who works around issues of civil rights knows that we have to be working on all fronts and knows also how critical things like the 2020 election cycle will be to ensure that we have every tool available to us, whether it's at the judicial level, the legislative level, or the executive level. We have to be savvy and very persistent about using every avenue to create the kind of change that's needed for any community that's under attack.
Without a doubt. Now is a good time for basically all hands on deck to join,
absolutely.
Right?
We wake up each day and say that.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, today it's playing out in a very high stakes, very high profile way, of course, but it also plays out in very quiet ways in people's the work people are doing every day across the South.
Well, absolutely. That's why these three plaintiffs, they're so courageous to come forward and let their private lives be put on display in this manner. Hopefully it'll work out. I'm thinking back to the day the Supreme Court decision was announced on marriage equality and the end of DOMA. And oh, man, what was her name? I can picture her.
Edie Windsor.
Edie Windsor. I mean, she became just an icon, not only for the LGBTQ community, but for progressive Americans who want to see us move in a forward direction, equal rights for all. What an amazing woman she turned out to be. And I have a feeling we're going to get to know these three plaintiffs after today as well.
Yeah, and that's really what's powerful about cases like these and other cases we've seen throughout American history is it's the lives of everyday Americans who have experienced injustice and have said, I'm ready to stand up and I'm going to share my story, often at great risk and sacrifice to themselves and their private lives, but to do that in the greater good. So we certainly are sending so much support to the plaintiffs and their lawyers working with them. You know, what we also know is that for each of the plaintiffs in these cases, their story represents so many other stories.
Mm-hmm.
We regularly hear stories of people who they've been fired from the job, they maybe didn't get a promotion they seemed very qualified for, they didn't even get through the interview process, and they heard explicitly hostile things either about their gender identity or their sexual orientation. And there often isn't recourse for folks, and that's what we're trying to do. It's just establish the basic right that should be a right for everyone, which is that you can show up to work, be treated with respect and dignity, and do the job that you're being paid to do and not have to hide who you are while you go about your day. There's a recent report showing that 46%, almost half of LGBT people, report being closeted at work.
Mm.
And we're closeted when we fear that we can't share who we actually are because we fear there will be negative repercussions. And we know people cannot do their best work when they're having to constantly regulate what they share about their lives and how they go about their work.
Of course, I couldn't even imagine having to hide the essence of who I am. And sadly, a big portion of the population has to. Our guest is Jasmine Beach Ferrara, Executive Director of the Campaign for Southern Equality. Their website is southernequality.org, and I was just looking at it. And, you know, you mentioned you fight for working to build a South where LGBTQ people are equal in every part of life. But if you, under your Our Work tab, you've got a bunch of things, including community health program, and volunteer opportunities. So what other things do you offer? Maybe somebody who's living somewhere in the South feeling alone, is there a way to work with you guys?
Absolutely. One of the main things we do is try to make sure folks know they're not alone. And luckily, we live in a digital age where there's lots of ways to connect. We publish a Transgender in the South resource guide, for instance, that provides a comprehensive listing of trans family providers across the South.
Oh, nice.
We had more than 18,000 folks visit that this year, so we know that's a resource that's really moving through our community across the South. We always invite people to become part of the movement we're building. There's lots of ways to engage through digital actions, through connecting to events in your local community. And we do more and more work around community health issues, recognizing that the right to get the health care you need in your hometown is another one of those fundamental areas of what it means to be not only equal under the law, but equal in how we conduct our lives. So we're getting ready to release the findings of a Southern LGBTQ health survey that will provide a really large and comprehensive look at the experiences that queer Southerners are having with health and some opportunities we have to improve access to health care and the quality of health care that Southern LGBTQ folks are getting, especially around issues of HIV and AIDS and around transgender health care needs. So we do a lot of different work across a lot of different spheres of life, but at the end of the day, what it's all connected by is the experience someone has of being LGBTQ in the South. And you wake up in the morning, you go to school or you go to work, you have health care needs, you celebrate life's milestones with your family, and hopefully you have the opportunity to be who you truly are in the town that you call home. And that's why we work across healthcare, across employment law, across direct services, and across political advocacy, because it all ties together in the fabric of people's daily lives.
Wonderful. Again, the website is southernequality.org. Again, today is the day the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments about the rights of people to be who they are in the workplace without being discriminated against. There's no cameras in the Supreme Court. We generally get a transcript, though, the next day, sometimes even at the end of the day, so we can check on that. But unfortunately, we're probably not going to get a ruling on this until June, because this is one of those high profile cases that they usually wait until the very end of the term to announce a decision on, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So part of our job, and we're working as part of coalitions across the country, is to make sure that this is on people's radar screens, that people are educated about the cases and what's at stake. And as we build towards the expected ruling in June, there will, of course, be a major organizing effort to prepare for the different scenarios we could see and to figure out what next steps look like.
Perfect. Reverend Jasmine Beach Ferrara, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and giving us a background and telling us about Campaign for Southern Equality, because I know you guys do great work. Really appreciate your input and the work you guys do.
Well, thanks for your support on these issues and the opportunity to talk today. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Thank you again.
Bye.
There you go. Jasmine Beach Ferrara, the Campaign for Southern Equality. They do actually great work. I thought we were going to have more time. I told you this hour, there was a lot. So the hearing obviously today is over. We won't know much. I can fill you in more on the broadcast from some notes from people who were in the room. So we'll get to that. One other story that I did want to tell you about today has to do with the impeachment inquiry and all that. And basically, today was the day that the U.S. ambassador to the EU, a guy named Gordon Sondland, was supposed to give his deposition before the committees working on impeachment. Well, so he was scheduled to testify this morning behind closed doors. Shortly after 8 o'clock this morning, the news broke that the Trump administration blocked Sondland from appearing. His attorney, Robert Luskin, said, quote, "He's a sitting ambassador and employee of state and is required to follow their direction." So there's that. So he didn't. Now, he was not subpoenaed. He was requested to show up. And he didn't. So the word is that they're going to issue a subpoena for him now. In fact, here, the State Department waited. Oh, they called him at 12:30 last night to say you're not needing. Michael Isikoff at Yahoo News. The State Department waited until 12:30 this morning to tell Sondland not to show up for the deposition later this morning. The lawyer said he got the extraordinary middle-of-the-night directive in a phone call from a State Department official he declined to identify. The official offered no explanation of the grounds on which the State Department was blocking Sondland's appearance at the last minute. So, you know, they're still playing these stupid games, and it's just, frankly, bullshit. Anyway, with that, we are just about out of time. I was going to play What's News for you, but go to my website. Go to NicoleSandler.com, click on What's News, and you can listen there because I got to upload this to air on Progressive Voices at 5, and then I have to produce the broadcast for tonight. So, you know, when I'm back to my normal schedule, we'll do extended shows again. I just can't do it now. So tomorrow, Tom Hartman's going to be our guest, and I haven't even had a chance to read his book. I'm so woefully unprepared. Until later, we'll see you then or tomorrow. Thank you for listening, everyone. Have a great night. Bye-bye.